Well, as we referenced our text this morning in Exodus chapter 20, is going to direct us to this topic of sexuality and the sanctity of marriage. Certainly an issue that is front and center in our culture today, a culture that certainly is very saturated, in which sex is used in many different ways, for many different purposes. It's lauded and sought after. People are clearly looking for intimacy, satisfaction, and sex is often thought to be the key. Our culture flaunts a sexually unrestrained lifestyle as the ideal source of happiness. There's a restlessness that we see even in the prevalence of pornography. People looking for various avenues and perverted ways of satisfying this appetite. Physicians promise an enhanced sexual experience with a pill. People, of course, are looking for it in what is often called serial marriages, one after the other, looking for the person that is going to fully complete them or make them happy. Unmarried couples are looking for that quick fix, choosing to cohabit instead of committing themselves in a lifelong marriage. But it's clear that these various perversions and distortions of sexuality have proven not to satisfy. We're suggesting once again this morning that God has intended to fulfill us and bring us satisfaction and joy in the context of His restrictions. It's rather counterintuitive. But we've been using that analogy of the train on the tracks. Just as the train is most fully free when it is on the tracks, so we are most fully free and fulfilled and joyful when we function within the constraints and guidelines that God has established for us. And certainly that's true in this realm of sexuality as well. We function under the guidelines of a loving Creator who knows how we work, how we were created to function. And He's put these guidelines in place for our good, for human flourishing. And so we're going to suggest this morning that these desires are only fully satisfied in God's way. It's unfortunate that the church has too often dodged the issue of sexuality. And I understand why, as the one who's going to be talking about it today. Because my mind's racing, thinking, I don't want to be inappropriate, I don't want to be flippant, I don't want to, you know, offend people just in the way that I talk about this issue. So I think there's sort of this natural reticence that we have in this area. But it kind of goes beyond that. In some ways, the church not only has been silent at times, but too often it's talked about sexuality in a very negative context, sort of shrouded in this cloud of suspicion, talking only about what not to do and not really talking about God's beautiful design and God's purpose and His intent. And certainly this is true in church history, where for many periods of time it was seen, marriage and sexuality was seen as sort of a second-rate option to celibacy, that if you were really spiritual, then you would live this life of abstaining. And, of course, marriage was just sort of second rate. Tertullian, one of the early church leaders in the second century, regarded the extinction of the human race as preferable to procreation. That's pretty strong. Ambrose, another pastor in the 4th, 5th century, said that married couples ought to be ashamed of their sexuality. St. Augustine, was willing to admit that intercourse might be lawful, but taught that sexual passion was always a sin. Many priests counseled couples to abstain from sex altogether. Get this, the Catholic Church gradually began to prohibit sex on certain holy days, so that by the time of Martin Luther, the list had grown to 183 days a year. Wow. It is ironic that the 1631 King James Bible was printed in this context. That particular edition of the King James Bible included one notable misprint. It omitted the three-letter word, not. Exodus 20:14 was rendered, thou shalt commit adultery. Needless to say, that came as a bit of a shock to the church in 1631. Ironically, it was the Puritans who recovered a more holistic view of marriage and sexuality. They spoke about it plainly, as the scriptures do. They devalued celibacy, they glorified companionate marriage, they affirmed married sex as both necessary and good. They promoted a more biblical view of the exalted role of the wife. And certainly did a lot to help us recover a biblical perspective. So let's look at this very brief command this morning. Our scripture reading will be five short words. Exodus 20, verse 14. Hear the word of the Lord. You shall not commit adultery. And as we've been doing with each of the commands, we've been trying to review and rehearse and make sure that, if nothing else, at the end of these 10 weeks, we have got them locked into our minds, right? So hopefully you've been practicing at home, but we're going to do it together, all right? Number one, no other gods. Number two, no carved image. Number three, no misuse of the divine name. Number four, remember the Sabbath. Number five, honor your parents. Number six, no murder. Number seven, no adultery. All right, we'll remove it here. Try it one more time. No cheating this time. Some of you are just mouthing the words. Number one, no other gods. Number two, no carved image. Number three, no misuse of the divine name. Number four, remember the Sabbath. Number five, honor your parents. Number six, no murder. Number seven, no adultery. Well, what are the parameters here? If we just break down this command, what is it actually saying? How could we summarize it, put it in very plain terms? I think this is a pretty good definition. No one is allowed to have sex with any married person except his or her spouse. And no married person is allowed to have sex with anyone other than his or her spouse. In our house, we were just talking about this last night after dinner, and we just talked about sleeping with another person. That close relationship. That should be only for a husband and wife. No one else should have that close of a relationship with mommy and daddy. So we talk about that in those terms. Whatever those terms would be age appropriate for your family as you talk through this. But I think that's a pretty good definition. Now, Scripture does forbid a lot of other forms of sexual perversion or immorality, right? We could add to this list fornication, cohabitation, prostitution, homosexual sex, rape, pedophilia, incest, sexual abuse or violence. There's a whole host of things that we could talk about in this arena. The commandment specifically guards the sanctity of the marriage relationship. Okay, so it's not saying everything that there is to say, but it is saying something very specific as it pertains to marriage. And the sense is that illicit sex involving married persons is particularly condemned because it threatens the marriage relationship. Now, we would also want to say that This whole area of sexual purity is not just for married people, right? Last I checked, about a third of our congregation, adult congregation, are single. Either college students or, you know, adult singles or divorced or widowed. That's a pretty big chunk of our congregation. But the commandment certainly has implications for all of us. It's important for all of us to understand, have a really good handle on God's design for marriage. I thought Tim Keller had an interesting perspective. Tim Keller pastors a church out in New York City. And he has a great book on marriage, by the way, if you haven't read it, The Meaning of Marriage. But he talks about his particular context there in New York City, where marriage is really undervalued. I think about urban setting, educated group, predominantly he's got a lot of singles in his church. The majority of his church are singles, young adult singles, and marriage is sort of like, you know, it's the end of all the fun, the end of all the freedom, right? So in his context, he's having to guard against that. Hey, don't undervalue marriage. But he says in a lot of places, probably in most places, it's the other way around, isn't it? Marriage is, oh, if I just got married, if God just brought me to the right person, everything would be great. I wouldn't have any more problems. Right? So this is a bit of a distortion, right? We got two ends of the continuum here, and they're both wrong. So he says there's something really important about having just a good view of marriage to inform our thinking, so we don't undervalue it or overvalue it. There's something here for everyone, single and married alike. Well, why is adultery so serious? I mean, this is a pretty big deal. The punishments included death. Why was it so grievous to God? And this is not an exhaustive list, but maybe just some things to get you thinking. A married person belongs to someone else. Now, we would want to certainly talk beyond just in terms of property, but Paul talks about this in 1 Corinthians 7, that when you get married, you lose autonomy. You no longer make decisions simply for yourself. You don't have that prerogative anymore. You've been joined together with your spouse. And so there's this mutual ownership of each other, even physically, sexually. And so if a person is willing even to engage in some type of adultery, that's really irrelevant. It's not their choice to make. They're not free to make that choice. So a person's willingness or whether they're voluntary in the whole act really doesn't matter, okay? It's not, they're not free to give you what they're offering to give, right? Adultery is an act of violence. If you've been around situations where adultery has been present, you know the incredible breach of trust, the deep wounds that take place, not only between husbands and wives, but also in the lives of kids, how marriages are destroyed. Adultery is a desecration of the gospel. We reflected on this as it pertained to the Lord's table, that there's something more going on here than just a relationship between two human individuals. There's this symbolism that has been attached to marriage, that of Christ and His love for the church. So when we violate the exclusive nature of the marriage relationship, we are violating or defaming or marring the gospel. It's very significant. We would also see that the cost is great. Not just the cost for other people. We already spoke of adultery being an act of violence towards others, but also the cost to ourselves. The scripture is just pretty clear, especially when you look in the Proverbs. It says the person who does this lacks sense. They're not very smart. They're shooting themselves in the foot. They're doing something that is self-destructive. And we see it in all different levels. Their reputation, Proverbs chapter 6 talks about this. His disgrace will not be wiped out. The person who engages in these actions. It costs possessions. Talks about a person who goes to the adulterer, gets involved with her, is reduced to a loaf of bread, which is basically a kind of an analogy of poverty. They're brought to nothing. They lose everything. Tremendous financial cost when I give myself to a life of infidelity. And it costs your life. Thomas Watson reflects on this. The adulterer hastens his own death. As you involve yourself with someone else's wife, Proverbs talks about this as well in Proverbs chapter 6, verses 34 and 35. Money will not pacify the anger that is roused. Right? There's something there that goes beyond monetary compensation. You take your life in your hands. In a very real sense. Even beyond the laws that governed it in the Jewish nation. The cost is great. Well, let's look ahead for just a moment here at Matthew chapter 5 and ask the question, how does Jesus interpret this command? Because I think kind of considering the nuts and bolts of what Exodus 20 says is only part of our challenge, we need to really now understand what does it mean? What's really going on here? What's at the heart of it? And Jesus addresses it in no uncertain terms. Matthew 5, verse 27. Matthew 5, 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. So we see Jesus unpacking this command for us. And we could observe several things here. Adultery is an issue of the heart. It's not confined to simply a physical act. So undressing someone with your eyes constitutes adultery. Pornography, obviously, is an expression of this, a violation of this command. I think we could even say certain forms, not only of what might be called hardcore pornography, but certain forms of literature are extremely laced. I mean, romance novels, can I just say it without meddling too much? Okay, I'll meddle. Many romance novels, I mean, of course, especially some of the furthest extremes, 50 Shades of Grey, some of the best-selling books are geared for women. This is not just a men's issue, but they're creating these false relationships outside of one's own relationship with their spouse. This is really at the heart of what adultery is. And we'd have to certainly clarify that a tempting thought or an inordinate desire is not in itself sin, right? The question becomes what I do with that if I choose to fixate on it. The question isn't the first look or the glance or whatever happens to cross in front of me, but it's what I do with that if I take a second look or a third look or I fixate or I begin to engage in a process in my mind. So that's the point of decision. But however we slice that and identifying the beginning points of sin, it happens far in advance of the physical act or a sexual act. It's an issue of the heart. We see that it's a serious issue with eternal consequences. The culture wants to focus on, you know, unwanted pregnancies, AIDS, venereal disease, maybe the emotional pain that comes out of this type of involvement. But it's a lot more than that. We have passages like Ephesians chapter 5, verses 3 to 6, that say that the sexually immoral will not inherit the kingdom of God. Pretty clear here in Matthew 5, Jesus talks about, he's talking here in terms of hell. Not just temporal punishment, not just loss of finances or reputation, but there's something much more serious going on in this particular sin. And we also see that it demands radical intervention. You think you might be able to handle it, you think it won't move beyond your thought life, you think you can keep it confined to a pornography issue, You think maybe it's just a private issue that really doesn't impact others. And I would tell you, you're fooling yourself. Sin always affects others, even if they don't know about it. It impacts our relationships, and the fact is that you can't manage lust, inordinate desire that is unrestrained. Sin doesn't stay in its place. It's perhaps just one cancerous cell. I can handle it. But we know what happens next. The cell multiplies, right? The cancer isn't restrained. If it's not dealt with, it will progress. It will ultimately take your life. This is how Jesus says it is with sexual sin. It demands radical steps and intervention. So as we just think about this, let's have some audience participation here today. Heidelberg Catechism, question 109. As you think about the real intent of what this command is getting at here, I'll ask the question. You provide the answer. Does God, in this commandment, forbid only such scandalous sins as adultery? I also want us to spend just a few moments looking at some of the other texts where Jesus addresses this, because he connects some dots for us that I don't think we often connect. Okay, so we're going to just look at them briefly. I've given you these references here. I know we can't turn to all these passages, but Matthew 5:31, it was also said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except on the ground of sexual immorality, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. So I just want you to notice the connections between divorce and adultery, how this works. This is very important. In this particular text, Jesus is not so much focusing on the one who divorces. He's focusing on the one who's on the receiving end of a divorce. And what does he say? She is forced or made to commit adultery. Now, particularly the ancient world, there was no welfare system. There was no alimony. A woman would often be forced to remarry in order to protect herself and provide for herself. So what Jesus is saying is, if you divorce your wife, you're causing her to become an adulteress. You're forcing her to become an adulteress. And the person who marries her is also guilty of adultery, because in my eyes, she's still married to her husband. Right? You get that? These are the connections that he's making. Mark 10. And he said to them, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery against her. And if she divorces her husband and marries another, she commits adultery. So here it's focusing on the one who's doing the divorcing. And when they do it, they engage in an act of adultery, an act of unfaithfulness, whether it's the man or the woman. The text is pretty specific. It doesn't matter whether it's husband or wife that's doing this, but they're engaging in an act of adultery. They're committing adultery against another person, against their spouse. Luke 16, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. So he gives it here as more of a blanket statement. And this all leads us to 1 Corinthians 7. Now here we have the words of the Apostle Paul. But notice how Paul begins this. He says, to the married I give this charge. In other words, if you're married, here's my commands to you. But what does he say? Not I, but the Lord. In other words, I'm just telling you what Jesus said. Okay? I'm not giving you any new information here. I'm just summarizing for you the teaching of Jesus. And here it is. Here's the counsel. The wife should not separate from her husband. But if she does, she should remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband. And the husband should not divorce his wife. So we don't think, in our cultural context, we don't think of someone who's divorced and then remarries, there's no adultery there because they're divorced. And what we have to wrestle with is that marriage is not merely a legal contract between two individuals, but a covenant established in the eyes of God. It cannot simply be voided when one or both spouses choose. The government might pronounce a divorce, but that does not necessarily break the marriage bond in the eyes of God. So this is loaded here. As you begin to think about what adultery looks like and some of the ways it's carried out, even in legal terms within our culture. In Matthew's Gospel, we record Jesus' words include an exception. Except for porneia or marital unfaithfulness or sexual immorality, it's translated differently. There's one caveat there in which a remarriage does not constitute adultery. And it's a very difficult to understand a text. But here Paul's giving the blanket teaching of Jesus, and it's a very high bar, a very high expectation, an expectation of fidelity. Well, I want us to spend the few minutes we have remaining here this morning to ask what I think is the critical question. Understand what Exodus 20 says, kind of the nuts and bolts, the basic nature of the command. We get the interpretation from Jesus and all of the far-reaching implications of this command. So what can we do to pursue what I'm going to call holy sexuality, to maintain a godly pattern, a godly lifestyle in this particular area? Here's one piece of counsel. Keep your distance. Keep your distance. What I mean by that is that we are to stay away from people and places which are marked by sexual immorality. So the writer to Proverbs, he's writing to his adult son, and he says to him, keep your way far from the adulterous woman and do not go near the door of her house. Right? So nothing inherently wrong with walking on a given street or going by a certain door. But he says, create distance from places where you're going to find yourself in trouble. Right? Well, we have a similar sentiment expressed in Ephesians 5. But sexual immorality and all impurity or covetousness must not even be named among you as is proper among saints. Let there be no filthiness, nor foolish talk, nor crude joking, which are out of place, but instead let there be thanksgiving. So not only don't I do these things, but I shouldn't talk about them. I shouldn't joke about them. I shouldn't be desensitized to them. I shouldn't watch programs that are going to put forward or glorify sexual deviation. I don't in any way want my heart to be hardened. I don't want in any way for the church or the people of God to be associated with these things. I keep my distance. Right? I make some people angry, but I thought it at least raised the topic of dancing today. See, I grew up in a really, really, really conservative church. I mean, you just sat on your hands all the time. You know, just better not to do anything than to do the wrong thing. And I realized that, you know, there's been a shift, and I realized there's a lot of forms of dancing, line dancing, and you know, there's ballroom dancing, and there's swing dancing, and I don't know what all the dancing happens down at Rose Park Circle. I know there's a lot of it going on, all right? And I realize there's different types of dancing, so I'm not trying to make a sweeping statement, but there's a lot of dancing that just would create a lot of contact between two people that aren't married. That just isn't wise. All right, pick your dancing carefully. All right, we ought to not be saying, "Well, where's the chapter and verse that says I can't dance?" Well, there isn't one. Okay, I'm asking you to create safe distance from any situations or people that are going to cause temptation. All right, just establishing boundaries. By the way, that's not legalism. You can have a boundary, you can have a conviction, and not be legalistic. It's just wisdom. All right. Before I get all my legalistic replies this week. Number two, guard your eyes. The eyes are a pathway to sexual sin. Peter writes about that generation, they have eyes full of adultery. Job referenced his eyes. I made a covenant with my eyes not to look lustfully at a girl. And we need to take steps to guard our eyes. You know, there's images in my mind from my childhood, my adolescence, things that I was exposed to that are like, it's like a photograph and it's sitting right in my mind. We need to understand how images work, especially guys. Right, it's very... Watson, the Puritan, said that it's like poison to the heart. You know, it just it continues to fester those images. We need to understand that and take steps in advance to guard our eyes. So we have things like covenant eyes, and there's different ways we can do that to really to guard ourselves. Some have advocated patterns and disciplines of bouncing your eyes. So you see something, wow, she's beautiful. And I just keep looking. Right? I just keep my eyes bouncing. I don't allow them to fixate. Whatever that discipline is for you, but we need to have some disciplines that relates to our eyes. All right? Number three, establish emotional boundaries. I think this is a great text in 1 Timothy 5, 1 and 2. You say, you know, how should I relate? What would constitute an appropriate relationship with a person of the opposite sex who's not my wife or my husband? I think this is great counsel that Paul gives to Timothy. Do not rebuke an older man, but encourage him as you would a father. Younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, in all purity. You ought to treat a person who's not your wife like a sibling. And I would hope I wouldn't have to outline what is and is not appropriate behavior with your siblings, right? There's a couple actually good, we'll get to these later. Maintain an active, disciplined life. Number four, maintain an active, disciplined life. Idleness and isolation are a setup for temptation. The great text in Ezekiel 16, you say, what's going on with Sodom and Gomorrah, all the sexual immorality, the homosexual sex? How did they get there, you know? Actually, Ezekiel 16 addresses that in a pretty pointed way. It says, behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease. They were looking for something to do. That's a bad place to be, all right? That's David's issue, wasn't it? It's the time when kings normally go off to war, but the kingdom was secure, so he, you know, mixes up an Arnold Palmer, and he's sitting there on the top of the palace looking for something to do. And lo and behold, he found something to do. Right? So part of how we could really counter this is to be engaged in doing stuff. Find some ways to take your eyes off yourself and engage in serving other people. And get engaged in ministry. This is certainly a pattern that we need to take it. Maintain. We already talked about this, emotional boundaries. Yeah, emotional boundaries. I wanted to reference this too in that area of emotional boundaries. You think about this. These were some great responses on the connection card last week. If you are married, text messages with someone of the opposite sex must be for business only, quote unquote, meaning they are limited to practical and necessary coordination messages, not joking or for entertainment. Flirting, that's a great boundary. That's a great boundary. I thought this was good. Interact with the opposite sex in a context of Christian community. Tie in with sibling relationship, right, too? I mean, sibling relationship is not an exclusive relationship in the same way that marriage is. So don't limit, if you're not married to that person, enjoy their company in the context of Christian community. That's a good safeguard. Those are all ways of sort of guarding emotional boundaries. Maintain an active, disciplined life. Consider the consequences. Reflect on what would follow the momentary rush of pleasure. Proverbs 7 would be a great text to memorize. Talks about the speech of the seductive adulteress, persuading, smooth talk, and all of a sudden, there's an arrow that pierces his liver. You know, stop and think through what would be the outcome of this moment of pleasure. Joseph was doing this, wasn't he? I mean, he's the great example of restraint. Pharaoh's wife comes to him repeatedly, making passes at him, complimenting him. And he responds to her ultimately, "How could I do this and sin against my God?" He knew what was at stake. It's almost like it had been rehearsed. I think it had been. I think he'd been giving this speech to himself of what would happen if I were to give in to this temptation. We need to be rehearsing that as well. Number six, confess your sins and your struggles. James 5 speaks to the important role of confession. Sin loves and thrives in isolation. Find a trustworthy person of the same gender and acknowledge your sin. Number seven, and we don't have time to develop this, it's a bit simplistic, but get married. Not my counsel, Paul's. 1 Corinthians 7:2, "But because of the temptation to sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife and each woman her own husband." Now, clearly, marriage is not the end of temptation. In some ways, it's just the beginning, right? But marriage is God's prescribed context for sexual fulfillment. It's not the only purpose of marriage, but it is one of the purposes of marriage. And it's concerning to me that marriage is being delayed so much in our culture. Average age of first marriage now is 28. It keeps climbing. So you have this gap between physical or sexual maturity and sexual fulfillment. It's this danger zone. And it's getting bigger. And I think even as parents, we've got to be careful. So I have to talk to parents who are delaying marriage for their kids. In some cases, because of financial reasons, they want them to be more financially stable. Or maybe it's educational reasons. I'd like you to go on and get that master's degree finished before you get married. I think we have to be really careful of delaying marriage. I think we contribute in some cases to a dangerous situation. And I think this is true for individuals too who are delaying marriage. I'd speak particularly to guys. I mean, we live in a hookup culture. Many men want friends with benefits. If you're of that generation, you know what I mean. They want the perks of a relationship without the commitment. And the reality is, there's a lot of guys that have to grow up. That have to be willing to be an adult, take responsibility, to provide for a wife and a family. But I think some people, again, it's not all as easy as that. It doesn't just happen to say get married. But I think if this is an area of real struggle, you need to be taking intentional steps, even perhaps online dating. I referenced that a few weeks ago and got a lot of grief for it. But you better be intentional. If this is an area of concern, I think you need to be intentional about it, about finding a spouse. Well, the good news in all this is we come away realizing how difficult it is to master this area, to really fulfill this command. The good news is that there's hope for adulterers, both physical adulterers and emotional, mental adulterers. God's grace is sufficient for us. It's not an unforgivable sin. I'm struck with Jesus' response to the woman caught in adultery, and we'll close with this. Remember, she comes and Jesus extends grace, doesn't he? The things that the law could have required are not exacted in that situation. And yet, you remember how the conversation closes. Go and sin no more. There's grace, there's forgiveness, but God's serious about it. This is the standard. And we better be striving for it. May God help us to do that.